Thank you for supporting WBEZ. You keep public media public. December gifts are among the most important because they set the tone for our reporting in 2026. Next year, we're doubling down on bringing you stories that arm you with the facts. This journalism relies on everyone contributing what they can. Join them today at wbez.org/donate.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work offers a one-year advanced standing option for students with a bachelor's degree in social work that builds on prior training and connects students with expert faculty and 5 specialized pathways. Apply by February 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
For more than a decade, Vietnamese-American writer and poet Ocean Vuong has captured what life can be like as an immigrant living on the fringes of American society. Today, he's back with another tale of love, labor, and loneliness, the novel The Emperor of Gladness. Vuong is perhaps best known for his 2019 novel On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous and intimate poetry collections like Time is a Mother from 2022. In his new book, he gets even more vulnerable with a story about acting with kindness toward others, even when you're filled with hopelessness. And this just in, The Emperor of Gladness is also the latest pick for Oprah's book club. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. The book is set in a fictional Connecticut town and draws from Vuong's personal story growing up in Hartford, living in poverty and working a slew of low-paying jobs. I talked with him yesterday and started by asking what he wants people to understand about his upbringing and hometown.
Well, America is so large, and I think sometimes it's hard for her to see herself, particularly the parts of her that are not in the media. And growing up in Hartford, I didn't realize that Connecticut had a reputation of being very wealthy, private schools, yachts, mansions, until I left and went to New York and people said things like, oh, you're from Connecticut, so fancy. Mm. And it wasn't the fanciness that I saw, but it was not the depravity and the deprivation that people thought there was either. I grew up in a black and brown immigrant community with Haitians, Jamaicans, Dominicans, Puerto Ricans, and white folks who came as refugees from the Balkan Wars, from Yugoslavia, Serbia. So there was this incredible touchstone to American life. And I think the immigrant in this country, living in places like Hartford, sees that the American dream was not so real as it is Americans who dream. And I think that's what I'm interested in this novel, is that there are all kinds of dreams that we have, and all of them are dignified because we are fighting to survive in this place. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting because, you know, nowadays people see the economic blight that so many of us in those communities living through the 90s and the early aughts have seen for decades. And now there's even, you can go on YouTube and have this poverty porn. People film in their cars, these blighted communities, they never step out, all over the world. And one of them is Hartford. I clicked on this video one afternoon and I said, gosh, there's my childhood. And now it's entertainment for people all over the world to see how horrible we live. But for me, it was always hard, but it's never horrible because of the vibrant community that sustained my life and my family's life.
Yeah.
You know, when we came as immigrants, we were taken into the Baptist church with no questions. We had free food. We did the whole sermons. And what I saw was poetry, music, and kindness. And that, I think, made an indelible mark on who I am as a writer. And it took me a long time to be able to write a book that could say that. And I'm proud that I finally did.
You should really be proud of this work. It feels like you've always dabbled in putting yourself in your writings, but this feels like you put everything in. What inspired The Emperor of Gladness? Because you've said that you wrote this one for you.
It was my Noah's Ark, you know, being in the Baptist church. That was the first story I saw. Watching the preacher talk about Noah's Ark. What will you do, he said, when the apocalypse come, if you had a vessel to put everything that you loved, even unlovable things, into it? And that stuck. I was a baby. I was 7, 8 years old when I heard that. But that stuck with me. That's probably my North Star as an artist. And and I just didn't know how to do it in a novel this big until now. And yeah, you know, a lot of, in literary world, people say some self-indulgence is a bad thing. But I actually think it's a wonderful thing. Do we want Toni Morrison to be any less indulgent than she is?
Absolutely not.
Exactly, right? I thought it was very strange. And I want all of the writers, I want all of their obsessions. I want Maxine Hong Kingston to just go off, Baldwin to give me all of himself. And I think this is my most self-indulgent novel.
Yeah. Were you scared up until this point to go as far as you did in this work? Because you said it's so big and you weren't ready until now. What held you back from maybe some of the things you shared in this story?
I think your own success can give you a reason to be more daring. And I think I couldn't earn the maneuvers that I tried to do in this book. You know, this book starts in ways that I think, you know, most storytelling classes tell you not to start a book. An 8-page description of a place with no action, no people, nothing going on, but a very detailed zoom in of a characterization of this place. Mm-hmm. And it took me almost 10 pages and nothing happened. So I think any smart editor would tell you, oh gosh, let's get started. We need to tell this story. What are you doing? But I wanted to write a novel that only the novel could do. You know, I think I read a lot of books now and you open it up and you can almost feel like, okay, I think they're auditioning for the film option here. It just starts in medias res. It feels like a movie you've seen. And I just wanted the novel to just do something only the novel can do.
Yeah. You speak of the start of the novel. It makes me think of your opening line. Quote, "The hardest thing in the world is to live only once." And that's how you start the book, Ocean. So yeah. I literally closed it. I was like, okay, we're done here. Like, what else is there to say? The hardest thing in the world is to live only once. That's so true.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, and it's true in both ends, right? On the more troubling end, this country and our culture celebrates YOLO.
Yes.
You only live once. And that actually, the ethos there leads to a kind of self-destructive, let me just use whatever I have, harvest the resources, destroy our planet for profit, for self-gain. Let me just see the world that I live in as a kind of, you know, hotel room I can just trash and I'll just walk away and never have to turn back. But I thought another side of that is to see this place as something that is all we have. And if you have just one chance to pass through this place, do you really want to destroy it? You know, or do you want to live with an awareness that death looms large over all of us? And then death becomes the kind of the ultimate teacher to show you how to live better. And I think death haunts this book, but it is, I hope, full of life.
Yeah. When you were writing this, were you also considering U.S. politics and what's happening in our immediate world around us?
Absolutely. I set this book in 2009 on the cusp of, you know, Obama's first inauguration and the hope there. But that was my first political consciousness. And what I realized, you know, in retrospect and where we are now is that for whatever reason, regardless of who's in power, the working class and the working poor have never gotten an equal voice. And I see the same, you know, sort of same renditions. And what I realize is that where we are now with Trump, it's our own detriment to see him the way we often portray him, as the singular monstrous thing that arises out of nowhere. He is America's symptom. Mm. You know, America made Trump in the same way they made Andrew Jackson and Thomas Jefferson, right? So he is kind of the inevitable. And I see him as an outsider looking at it. I see him as something that was always going to come, whether it's in the name of Trump or not. Someone like him would come because he is a product of this country, this Machiavellian total power. You know, we celebrate endless progress and profit without shame. And when it comes to the artist, and Morrison says this best, you know, the artist is always told to sit down, be grateful that you have a seat at the table. Mm-hmm. We're always asked to perform humility. But they don't ask the people who make weapons to be humble. They don't ask the people who have endless profits on Wall Street to be humble. You never say, oh, we should pull back the blast radius as we're developing this bomb, or we should have lower profits next quarter. But the artist is always told to tone it down. Mm. Who do you think you are? But I am so grateful that I've come really late to the archive. I have a Baldwin. I have a Carlos Bolosan. I have a Baldwin who came before me and showed me that it was possible. So I feel really, really blessed to come so late to literature.
Mm-hmm. All those folks that you are able to just study that came before you. What a great place to be.
My goodness, imagine that they did it without them.
Right.
How did Morrison do it?
How did Baldwin do it?
Morrison?
Without a Baldwin.
I mean, they had some mighty others, but they didn't have them. Sure. Yeah. I'm just so stunned by that.
To some of the points you were making, there's a lot of work on the left responding to Trump's policies by strengthening community bonds, right? Mm-hmm. You're seeing a lot of, you know, rapid response networks to help protect people from ICE and ICE raids.
Yes.
Mutual aid efforts, making sure that everyone has food. People just getting to know their neighbors, know your rights sessions. And in The Emperor of Gladness, you're focusing on an unexpected friendship and a caretaking relationship that happens sort of between strangers.
Yeah.
So how does it feel then to have this book come out right now?
It's inevitable. I think when I worked in fast food, I realized that no matter your ideological differences, and my coworkers and I had plenty of them, you can have the most antithetic views to each other, but then you have to work. You have to labor through a shift. You have to sweat. And you have to start to see that your coworker sweating after 2 or 3 hours, her neck is drenched. And underneath that drenched sweat, you see her little locket, you know, with Mother Mary and her grandmother inside. Mm-hmm. And what I realize is that ideological differences are degraded with kinetic labor and community work. It's very hard to hate each other when we see each other in the immediate presence, when we talk to each other. It's almost Herculean to do that. And I watched that happen through the years at the fast food restaurant, because you realize that there are larger forces aimed to wipe you out. And maybe I'm a little bit naive, but I think, you know, communities can always take care of ourselves. And yes. I saw that in Hartford. You know, we didn't have the news channels or the media to show this. But again, the Black community that my family immigrated into understood our needs, I think, better than we did.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were kind of like overjoyed.
Yeah.
We came from a refugee camp. And I remember my family saying, oh my goodness, we have a sturdy roof and a window that opens and closes. I remember my mother opening and closing. And this is a tenement, you know, house in Hartford, this apartment. But when we start to enter the community, and most Asian Americans, most Vietnamese Americans fled as soon as they got to Hartford.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, no, 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 we need to go to California, Houston. My family, we're tired. They're like,
we are going to plant our roots here.
We're done running. So whatever this is, but they were also They were rice farmers from the paddies, so they were so grateful to have structure, roof, and even KFC, fast food. You know, the Salvation Army gave us a pamphlet of KFC coupons. And I remember we were so happy to eat this. And it was the Black and Brown community that saw us with an eye for the larger system of American white supremacy. And they're like, okay, this is larger. We're going to take care of you. We know you have nothing. And we're going to have to prepare you for this whole thing. And I'll never forget that. And I think that's, to me, to this day, I see this even in literary theory or the archive. It's like every question that I ever had for myself as an Asian American author has already been considered deeply and robustly by a Black writer. Diaspora, identity, language, using vernacular, using standard English, what do we do with the archive, writing truth to power, all that is in the Black American canon, and that is an American tradition. We often think of Whitman and Dickinson. It's also Phyllis Wheatley and Jupiter Hemming who were writing as enslaved people. That is the American tradition. It starts way before Whitman and Dickinson, and I was deeply lucky and empowered to be able to point to those as inspirations, as well as the ones in the textbooks.
You are also speaking to my childhood, Ocean. I mean, I'm Jamaican, born and raised, and our immigration story was to Toronto, Canada. And it was very much the same, where my mom, you know, got right into the healthcare industry. And she, you know, first she started taking care of people, just like private support work, caretaking, whoever she could find, and then was able to get her education and get into nursing homes. But then, you know, doing those crazy shifts, right? 3 to 11, and then sometimes 7 to 3, just round the clock just to make ends meet. And the biggest supporters in her life were other immigrants, right? Filipino friends, friends from different parts of Africa. Same thing was happening to me as a child going to school. My friend crew was from Ghana, from Jamaica, from Bangladesh, and from Portugal, you know? And that's kind of just what it was, right? We just looked out for each other. We supported each other. We just understood each other in ways that our peers, our new peers in this new country could not.
That somehow, to me, both feels very Canadian and very American in the idealized way that they always talk about, but they don't talk about that part. And that to me is such a quintessential experience. And at its best, the great promise of this country is the diverse survival artist.
Yeah.
You know, we often think of the survivor as this passive victim. The refugee just needs food and they're just an open mouth taking resources. But if you ever met people like the people in your family and mine, you realize that they are creative artists. To survive is not just sitting there waiting for the storm to pass. You have to make things, you have to improvise, you have to innovate. And so we come from survival artists. And so I say I come from a long line of artists. I'm just the only one that put it into words.
Ocean, this is the first book that you have written without your mother here on earth with us. As we talked about, it also happens to focus on intergenerational relationships. You think there's a connection there? Maybe good timing to release a book of this sort when you're reminiscing on the loss of perhaps some of your deepest intergenerational relationships? Thinking of your mom, your grandmother, even?
Yeah, I wanted to write a book to just honor their life. You know, I'm very proudly raised by women. Mm-hmm. And I learned right away that people thought being raised by women meant I came from a broken household. But I've always thought that if there's enough love in the house, even hard love, it's never broken. And that whole myth of like the nuclear family, having a father, the head of the household, was a myth. Mm. And having come to know my father much later in life, I'm glad I was spared.
Oh, man.
I dodged a big bullet there. And so I think I wanted to reframe that and honor their life. And it's hard because it's hard for me to really be proud of this book.
Why do you say that?
Well, because everything I did was for my mother. And when I was writing this book, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy where I said, gosh, I can't love this book too much because it'll feel like I'll betray her. It's a silly thing, but you know, it's like when I'm finally writing for myself, I'm turning away from my mother, which you have to. Your mother passes, and as an artist, you have to start to look elsewhere and look forward. But this is the first time I'm doing it, and and it's still hard for me to really, you know, see it as a triumph.
But you know, she's proud of you for taking that step.
Yeah,
she's still watching. She's still watching.
Thank you for that. I think it's going to be a slow growth for me to eventually be really proud of what I've done. But I hope I'll get there soon.
I mean, you are dealing with real life things. You're dealing with trauma, grief, anger. Mm-hmm. Would you say today you're still angry, Ocean?
Well, as Baldwin says, if you're not angry, you're not awake. You're not paying attention. And so I think anger to me is always a part of this country. You know, I want to also just not put it on myself or people of color who are struggling. You know, I think as any American, you should be angry because you're living in a country that speaks of justice but doesn't know how it's formed. And so you should always be angry. And I think that's the fuel for a lot of what I do. But I think also care, consideration, empathy, community building, that's still anger, but that's the aftermath of anger. That's anger's second phase. And so I work more productively in anger's second phase. I let the anger come through me. I feel it. And then when I have to get up and care for things, that's the aftermath of anger. But that's where I'm most productive to my work and myself.
Mm-hmm. How then do you pace yourself as you're dealing with those emotions in the writing process? Are you taking breaks? Do you find that necessary?
Oh, God, I don't know that answer yet, Sasha.
Trying to figure it out still, right?
Oh, God, I'll let you know when I find out. I mean, it's like any artist, you have to steal time in this country. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't, it's not a given to have the time. The market will take what you write, but it's almost like a black market. It's like, we'll take it if you have it, but don't tell us how you made it. And very few people will support you making your work. So, you know, you become a good thief of time. You become a time thief, and it's often your own time, your own life. It costs the time of your family, your friends, which is why I write at night often. I don't know how long I can do that, you know, I want to make sure everybody in my family is taken care of. All their needs are met before I can do my own work. Morrison did the same. She woke at dawn. I try to do that. Can't do it. I'm not a 4 a.m. scribbler like she was, you know. But I'm a 2 a.m. scribbler.
Yeah, 2 a.m. So. I was going to say, I find that hard to believe. I know you're doing, you're pulling some late nights for sure. Well, you are on your way here to Chicago, and we're so excited. You're coming in for the Chicago Humanities Festival next week. What are you looking forward to most when you're here in the windy city for that event?
I love Chicago. Every city is distinct, but every time I go to Chicago, it reminds me of Hartford, because you know you're in the center, but you drive 30 minutes in any direction, you'll be in a cornfield.
that's true.
That's exactly Hartford. You know, Hartford maybe tobacco fields, a little different, but I think many people think, oh, that's a kind of loss, that it's kind of like a city in the Midwest or what have you, not at the center of the coast. But I think that's actually what makes Chicago so interesting, in the same way Hartford is so interesting, you know, because we used to have a saying in Hartford that all the good things are sucked up by Boston and New York, right? And it was kind of like this self-deprecating thing. But I actually thought it was enriching because I came to know all of American life. And I think Chicago is the same way. You see folks from all walks of American life right there within reach. And that's an incredible power rather than a loss.
Yeah. You talked earlier about dreams, the American dream. Do you dream? And if so, and I'm talking about in present day, what are you dreaming about? And do you see dreaming as different from hope? Because in the book, we're talking about kindness, where there is no hope.
Yeah. I do dream. My dreams have changed through the years. You know, I was a very optimistic. And I do believe there's a difference between hope and optimism. You know, hope is more about finding the solutions in the everyday. And optimism could be blind. It could be sort of just kind of willy-nilly mm-hmm. optimism, you know, without practice. But hope is something you have to really practice. And you can apply hope to the smallest things. You know, helping a relative through a mental health crisis requires hope. And the dream is the more abstract. It's more the North Star. You know, where are we headed? Where do we go? And I can only dream relative to my small work as a writer. And for me, it's important to realize that people are not bad. There's no such thing as bad people. There are only bad ideas. Because if we conflate bad people with badness or evilness, then in order to get rid of bad people, you have to get rid of people. And history has already tried to do that to devastating effects. And so my idea is that, you know, it's a Buddhist concept. We believe that bad ideas haunt people, but they can be salvaged. They could be rehabilitated, and they could transform. People can always transform. And literature, as evidence in my own life, is a way where some transformations can happen on your own terms. You know, there's no program or political movement to transform you, but you have to do it on your own. And that's what I really dream about. I dream about the possibility of people's worst intentions or misinformed intentions on either side of the political spectrum, that they could be sort of rehabilitated beyond that, without having to think about destroying people in order to destroy bad ideas.
We've been speaking with award-winning poet, essayist, and novelist Ocean Vuong. His new novel, The Emperor of Gladness, is out now, and you can find it wherever books are sold. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sasha. It's a deep honor.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by me, Sasha Ann Simons, Linnea Dominic, and Ellie Gilbert Baer. It was also mixed by Ellie. Arts, news, culture, politics, you name it, and we cover it right here on the show. Make sure to never miss a conversation by subscribing wherever you listen or at wbez.org/reset. Thanks so much for listening. We'll meet again tomorrow.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely.